Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, John and David from the Lorehounds have stopped by to help me cover Theon's first POV chapter. A couple weeks ago, I got an email from my friend Heather, who said, "I do not envy the person you bring on to cover this chapter because it's super gross." And it is. It is very gross. Theon's kind of a gross guy. Let's just call that out. Theon is kind of a gross guy. But my guests today are not gross guys. They're actually perfect gentlemen, and they're great podcasters, and my favorite of their podcasts is their coverage of the Silmarillion, and I'm hoping to join them on one of those chapters coming up soon. Okay, without further ado, here's Bosmang Aeron.
Ask Aeron anything!
Megan says, as I watched more of the first season of House of Dragon, I found myself getting very irritated at the sheer power that Daemon could be wielding and is not. He could be climbing that damn ladder better than Littlefinger, and instead he's fucking around with his brother. I get it. He's resentful because his brother has the throne and he's no longer the heir apparent. Great. He can marry her before all this next male heir and or wedding talk and seat himself squarely as a cunning element in the small council, impress everyone with his ruling ability, and ultimately convince old Viserys to retire the family jewels, knowing that both of the natural heirs will be married and produce offspring together. Strong leadership from Daemon at this point could sway those in power to see him as the rightful successor with the cock, and Rhaenyra as the official blood of Viserys. At the start of the show, he literally has it all in his hands, and instead he plays stupid games and steals eggs and tries to wed his whore and claim she's pregnant and ultimately diluting the Targaryen's blood. It's grating thinking about how brutal the things in Game of Thrones got, how bad life can be, only for the Targaryen to be painfully aware of how great they have life. In fact, there's hundreds of different plays he could make that make a ton more sense than just fucking around, like marrying his cousin Rhaenys pre-Valyrian, marrying their daughter, or just having an obscene amount of Targaryen children to interbreed with the current players. Having kids that were married to Rhaenyra, the Valyrian kids. At this point, he could have had a kid that he marries off to Alicent Hightower. But he's just stumbling through the game, which produces the end of their line. Ugh. I think Daemon's supposed to be a frustrating character. Like, he's supposed to be a failure of realized potential.
I think that this is... I don't think I've ever disagreed with feedback more than this, Megan.
Uh-oh.
And I'm sure you're a very fine person. But this is baked into being a second son. Baked into being a second son is that... you resent your older brother. You think that you could do it better than the older brother. You live your whole life in the shadow of your older brother. And you kind of love that guy. And that creates this inner conflict. And I think that Daemon Targaryen is more interesting because he actually loves his older brother. Mm-hmm. Not less interesting. That's my take on it.
Yeah, and like everything you said about second sons is like, when you talk about in the line of kingship, it's like super second son, because like, yeah, it probably sucks to be a second son of a you know, a Manderly or, you know, the Royce or something like that, where it's like in your, you know, you're talking about climbing to the top of a minor house in an also ran region of the of Westeros. But like, you're so close to the throne that,
yeah,
you know, a case of infertility and a bad war wound can put you on it. But it must be really frustrating. And the other thing is, you got to understand that, like, you know, Daemon and Viserys went through a lot. You know, they lost their father at an age where it's big impact on them. You mm-hmm. know, they grew up in the shadow of this great man, Jaehaerys. A lot of big shoes to fill. And I think his kind of, like you say, fucking around, his acting out, it's frustrating and annoying, but I think it's intended to be that. And it's realistic.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that Daemon actually wants to be on the Iron Throne? Or do you kind of think that he loves the battlefield too much, or he loves action too much, or he loves being the rogue prince too much?
I
that
think
he kind of aspires for it, but he almost doesn't, he wouldn't know what to do with it if he actually
yeah
got
it's
it.
Like what the Joker says, I'm like a mad dog that find, you know, like just chasing cars, like I wouldn't know what to do with yeah. if I caught it. And I think that's like Daemon likes being able to sulk about not being king, and like if I were king things would be different, but like I think he's smart enough to know if he got on the Iron Throne, it'd probably be a materially worse condition for him in his life. You know, like he couldn't get away with the things he could do. And
yeah, it's like Bobby B is like he's Bobby B's miserable on
right.
the Iron Throne.
Because the other thing is like when you see Daemon talking to Rhaenyra, he knows better. Like he knows a lot of the political things. He knows the importance of the small folk. He knows, you know, he could probably do a lot better than he's doing, you know, because he wasn't raised by mm-hmm. fools and he had a lot of good examples. It's just that he decides to let his worst nature take over. And again, it's super frustrating. But if you've ever had family yeah. members, if you had a brother or sister that, you know, fucks around and messes with, you know, drugs and alcohol instead of doing the, you know, and gives you, it's like it happens and it's super frustrating. And, you know, they. But the question is, like, could he do, like, could Daemon just consciously decide, I'm going to do better? I don't know, because I do feel like people are kind of like, you know, they're a lot of their like starting conditions and the life impacts and the genetics kind of go together. And I don't know. I don't think a lot of people have that kind of like conscious choice over the direction of their lives.
I don't think that Daemon enjoys being thought of as a ne'er-do-well. I think that he would like more respect. He would like people to look at him and think he would make a fantastic king. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he actually thinks he will enjoy it.
I agree with that. I don't think he would enjoy being the king. And I think he is the one of the reasons he's never tried to make a overt play for it is that he probably knows it wouldn't be fun.
Megan, no hard feelings. All right. This is from Zoran. When we finally meet the Lord of Storm's End, Boros Baratheon, I was a bit disappointed that it wasn't Mark Addy who played Bobby B. Having the same actor play both ancestor and progeny would have been a nice bit of fan service. After all, the family resemblance for the Baratheons is said to be strong indeed. The original series wasn't shy about stunt casting from time to time. He cites the actors who played Ilyn Payne and whoever Ed Sheeran played. Is there an actor from the original series that could also work in House of the Dragon? What do you think? Let me just say, I think this is a great idea. If it was Mark Addy on the throne when you walked into Storm's End, it would have been fun. I think that, you know, give him a different beard, give him a slightly different look about him.
Right.
I would absolutely believe that the Baratheons share a strong family resemblance.
Yeah, the seed is strong. I was trying to think, I would like to see Rory McCann, because man, I've recently got on TikTok and, you know, it learns your proclivities pretty quickly. And it started showing me a steady dose of like the most awesome scenes of Sandor Clegane when he's going to eat every chicken in the room.
Sure.
When he's wanting to personally kill the bandits that killed his mentor. And they won't let him because they the brotherhoods of that banner want to do justice themselves. And there's just like he's just got so many great lines when he takes on Brienne to try to save he's got so much. And I'm trying to think, it's like there's lots of canonically big men Like Harwin Breakbones, you know.
Yeah, why not recast Rory for Harwin? I mean, I guess
he's too old. He's too old for that. Yeah. But I also thought it might be fun because, like, there is there's some just suggestions that like Brienne might have the blood of Sir Duncan the Tall in her.
Yeah, yeah.
But like Sir Duncan the Tall happens like a century after this, and Brienne's a century after that. But like, could you put Gwendolyn Christie in? Like, you know, some Tarth, or it'd be really funny to like gender bend her and make her like Lord of Tarth and like, you know, just put her in like a blonde beard and, you know, she's just tall and she's got just the chain armor and, you know, and it's like, oh, wow, you can, you know, like it might have skipped a few generations, but I can see where it came from kind of thing. That might be fun, but
you know, I'm surprised.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that they've never used George for like a minor part.
Yeah.
Like someone's uncle who doesn't have a lot of lines. I
make a hell of a maester too.
I think something like that. I think that there's
has he never? I think you're right. He's never been any like not even like, or he'd be good like feasting at a table with ale running through his beard, grease dripping out of his beard.
You don't even have to
like
give him any lines. Books,
you know, he can show us how to drip grease with the best of them. Yeah, that'd be because honestly. As fun as this is, I also think there's a chance that, like, anytime you talk about fan service, you're also flirting with cringe.
I think so.
It's a delicate dance. It's a delicate dance.
Yep. I think you're right. It's probably a safer place to stay away from it, but if you were going to do it, it would have to be a minor part.
Yeah,
right?
I think so.
Okay. Well, that's all I have for feedback. And so if you have feedback that you would like read... book@baldmove.com.
Thanks for having me back.
What do you have coming up?
I appreciate it.
Yeah, what do you got coming up in the next couple weeks?
Oh,
here,
man, we are about to get extremely busy. We're right now in the throes of The Last of Us, the aforementioned fungal zombie apocalypse show on HBO, season 3 of Picard, which is a trash fire show, but it's bringing back all of the cast from The Next Generation. So me and Jim are like us being called like a siren to the rocks. We're gonna have to this show doesn't get any traffic for us, but it's a fun little community and we have fun kind of ripping on the show, and maybe it'll be good this year, who knows. We got the Yellow Jackets coming out pretty soon after that. That's this very creepy mystery kind of Lost intrigue type show that's on Showtime. I know I'm forgetting something else that's coming back to. Oh, and then The Mandalorian will be coming back in March. So like we've got and they're all kind of overlapping and interweaving with each other. But we're gonna try to roll with the onslaught.
If you have a question for Aaron or Anthony, you can send those to book@baldmove.com.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, it's a very special occasion for Electric Boogaloo. I'm welcoming John and David of Lorehound fame. John and David, thank you for jumping on the podcast with me.
Thanks for inviting us. We feel pretty special to be here. Boogaloo's been, Boogaloo's been a bright and shining star in the Bald Move constellation for a while. So
I like that you accidentally went to the old Scottish shite. Which is good for this particular chapter. I think I might have brought you on for the grossest chapter of the entire series. Well, maybe not the entire series, but so far in the books, Theon Greyjoy is he's not putting his best foot forward, let's just say.
No, he's not.
Nope.
So let's talk about your relationship with this book. My impression is that one of you was sort of a show-only guy till recently, and one of you sort of has a deep, abiding love for the books. Is that right?
John is more of the book hound. I've read all the books, but I read them quickly, and I don't remember if they were concurrently when I watched the show, because I remember I didn't know anything about the show. And then I was house-sitting for some friends. I'd been abroad for a while, and I had just come back, and was house-sitting for some friends, mm-hmm. and I didn't know what was going on in the world of television. And I stumbled across, I was like, oh, HBO, what are you know, there's got to be something going on. And I found this thing, and like, you know, whatever it is, 14 or 15 hours later, I awoke from a deep stupor going, what did I just watch? Give me more.
So, David, you watched the show before you read the books, right?
Yes. Yeah. And then I picked up the books along the way somewhere and read them quickly and just devoured them.
Yeah.
And
I did. That was kind of my, like, I watched the first season before I had read any books. What about you, John?
I did the same thing. I don't know what season I was at when I read the books, but I definitely started the show first. I was at a friend's house and they were watching Game of Thrones. They said, oh, you haven't watched this. Are you worried of spoilers? I was like, I'm never going to watch this.
Yeah.
And they put the Red Wedding on. And that was the first thing I ever saw of Game of Thrones.
That's awesome. That was your first episode.
That was the first one. And I was like, well, that was a lot. But no, I didn't remember it. So I went back eventually and I watched it. And I got to that scene and I suddenly recognized what was happening. And I went, oh, no. It was like a slow motion thing.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I was a huge fan. I bought your book back in the day.
I did too.
Yeah, so I was a huge fan. I was like, I can't get enough of it. I was writing into Bald Move every week. And then season 8 came out and I went fan bankrupt.
Oh, which no.
Drove me into the arms of J.R.R. Tolkien.
Bankruptcy, huh? All right.
It's true. It drove me into the arms of Tolkien.
Uh-huh.
And that's how we ended up lore hounding.
Oh, that's your origin story. That's great.
It really is. The failure of Game of Thrones season 8 writing was really my Lorigin story, if you will.
Oh, very nice. Very nice, sir. John. Very well done. All right, so let me read the synopsis of this chapter. Theon Greyjoy sails at last to his childhood home. After ruining the life of the captain's daughter, he's met by his uncle Aaron at Lordsport. Aaron, now a priest of the drowned god, baptizes him and belittles his claim as heir. Theon arrives to the Bloody Keep to a chilly reception, dresses, and then meets his father in his solar. Balon Greyjoy accuses his only remaining son of dressing like a whore, slaps him when he talks back, and mocks his relationship with the Starks. Balon is insulted further by Robb's letter. The Lord Reaper will not be given a crown. He intends to take it instead. So, Lorehounds, what do you bring to the table today?
One thing that I thought was really interesting that I think this whole chapter did was sort of give you this dissonance between the misogyny that Theon really leans into on the boat and that, you know, is kind of casual on the island, and the island's ability to sort of look realistically at having a female ruler, at having Asha be the heir.
That is really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because he is, I mean, you couldn't create a more misogynistic character than this guy.
I know, yeah.
He doesn't, I don't even think he knows the name of the captain's daughter. He basically, he's on this ship for what, a day? Is it even more than half a day? I don't even know how long it's been. I guess it's been from Old Town to the Iron Island, so that might be a couple days.
But where did he? I think he got in like Seaguard, or
yeah, something like that. He takes the captain's chambers,
yeah,
deflowers his daughter, ruins her life because now her father is going to treat her horribly. She says so much.
Probably sired a bastard.
The girl is willing to just sort of hang around as his concubine, and he casts her off and. At the end of it, we don't even hear her name. Like, we don't even know this person's name. And he refers to Catelyn as the wife or the mother, doesn't name her. This guy has almost zero respect or zero acknowledgement for women in power. And then he arrives to find out that maybe his sister has a better claim as heir than he does.
Kind of a interesting twist on the prodigal son, right?
Oh, say more about that.
Well, here he is coming back thinking that he is going to be his father's heir. Uh-huh. He's been, he's warred, he's gone to battle, he's learned the ways of the court, he's been educated.
Yeah, he's painted himself with glory, right?
Yeah, and he's ready to, you know, take up his father's mantle.
But instead the father... Instead of like welcoming him with open arms, the father
backhands him.
Yeah, slaps him and says, "Your sister's more of a man than you are," basically.
Exactly.
Oh, man. Oh, goodness.
So, yeah, it kind of takes the prodigal son story and turns it upside down a little bit.
Were either of you kind of a little bit taken aback that, like, wait a second, Aaron Dampier is meeting Theon at the dock? Like, what happened to Asha Yara? I thought she was going to meet Theon. Or was it sort of like, no, I kind of remember that this is how the book went.
I mostly remembered. Well, I don't know, because I haven't read the books in a few years. I knew that it was different. I knew that the whole weird horse scene didn't happen.
That was a little odd.
Yeah, it was odd. The show added a lot of stuff like that. That was like, I wonder why you added that, guys.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean, I thought that this was good. I really enjoyed the way he was welcomed. As I was reading it, I was like, if I'm gonna pick a movie scene that has the same vibe of this chapter, it's Joe Pesci thinking he's a made man and then going in and going, oh shit.
Yeah, that, you got it. You nailed good it. Call. That's it. Yeah, Theon is I apologize. I say Theon because
that's right. We say Galadriel. Okay. What do we call her?
We've cured ourselves, though. We're
so
better now.
I know a lot of people say Theon, and I think that that is the correct pronunciation. For some reason, when I see his name, I see it in Greek font because I teach Greek. And the way that you – it looks exactly like the word for God in the accusative form.
Interesting.
And
okay.
I cannot cure myself of that. So I will probably say Theon – over and over and over. I know it's Theon. Don't write in and tell me that I'm pronouncing it incorrectly. I know that I am. So anyway, I almost think that having Aaron, the priest, meet him at the dock was a really effective way to show how precarious Theon's claim to his father's seat is.
Uh-huh.
Because if it was Asha Yara there, you know, who's going to sort of trust her on her own prospects? But to hear, like, the chief priest of the entire culture and your uncle kind of throw a little bit of shade on you and say your sister still lives, that absolutely gives legitimacy to Theon's sister.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I kind of took it all in a bit more of a utilitarian fashion. I just felt this whole chapter was very utility driven.
Hmm.
There's other things I liked about it. I love some of the environmental descriptions and some of the writing. I've even got a quote that I really enjoyed.
Hmm.
But I thought it was a good and effective way of introducing us to the drowned god, to the phrase, what is dead may never die. Yeah. And so I felt like, oh, this is good. I'm like, you know, retrospectively reading the chapter in preparation for this podcast, I was like, oh, wow, I can see what he's doing here in the world building and then having his uncle be there, which is a slight, right? Because he's not getting the pomp and circumstance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But is his uncle also checking him out a little bit, or is he, you know, but just from the utility factor of introducing us to the Iron Islands culture and religion, I thought that was effective vehicle.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, the other thing that I thought that it did well here was, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm a little hazy on my Westeros lore, but the Greyjoys were installed by one of the Conquerors, right? By either Aegon or by Robert. So the hereditary nature of the leadership of the Iron Isles is a relatively new thing to this culture, right?
Well, new in the sense that the culture is like 5,000 years old, and Aegon conquered, you know, Westeros 300 years ago, right? So, yeah, the whole Harren the Black episode kind of shifted, I guess you could say, the leadership of the Iron Islands. But I do get the sense that the Greyjoys are, they don't view themselves as newcomers. They view themselves as sort of wanting to keep the old way as much as possible.
Sure.
That was another thing that came through really in the chapter two, is this old versus new. Mm-hmm. But anyway, John, you know, keep going on your point.
Well, I was just thinking, like, I kind of got the sense from this that, like, it's not like Westeros where they expect the son to inherit no matter what. It is very much more a culture where they are slightly more meritocracy-ish with their leadership. So. And I think that that comes across with the way that Theon is welcomed.
Right, because, of course, you know, even though there hasn't been sort of a king's moot in a while, there's at least precedent for something like that.
It's odd because they're clinging to these old ways, but that's the one that they let go of. And I know that later they bring it back, but I think it sort of foreshadows that too really well.
And that goes into the whole thing of paying the iron price.
Right.
Right. If you're going to be head of this, you know, group of people, then you need to, you don't just by dint of bloodline get to be the boss. You've got to make sure that you can hold your own and then some. And be it a king's mood or just being a good reaver or whatever, you've got to be constantly demonstrating your strength.
Yeah, I got the sense with this that, like, Martin was trying to kind of tell you how old and, I guess, almost archaic the Ironborn culture is. In other words, like, you know, their words don't even really make sense anymore. We do not so. Because, of course, you know, from Theon's perspective, they do so now. They have a little, you know, they have little farms. You know, they're not getting rich off these farms, but they're no longer allowed to just raid Westeros for what they need anymore. They don't do salt wives and rock wives anymore. That has changed. You know, it's not like the Lord Reaper is a king. He's just a lord. So there's a lot of ways in which this culture has changed over time. But you almost get the sense that it's a little bit about, like, people clinging into the Confederacy. It's like this is an occupied people. And so they're living more in the past, in the glory days of the past, than they are. Things in the present are just very bleak for the Greyjoys.
I think, too, this makes an interesting point of Theon's returning, because he's returning having been a ward of the Starks, who were Robert Baratheon's, you know, right hand in terms of, you know, Robert's rebellion and all of that, and conquering and subduing the Iron Islands. And there's some battle descriptions in this chapter, which are kind of cool, again, for a world building standpoint. But you can really tell Balon's animus towards the Starks through his son, and the way he treats his son and the way that he suspect, did you pay the iron price for that necklace?
Yeah.
You know, I won't have my son, you know, parading around like a whore,
yeah,
you know,
right.
And Theon, like, dresses in finery and does all this stuff. And, you know, he's coming in with sort of these new ways. Oh, you know, Rob's my friend and we're going to, like, you know, do all this cool stuff. And Balon's like, the hell we are, because it was the Starks and the Baratheons who took our culture from us. And now you're showing up here with the smell and the look of those people.
Yeah, Balon's really insult. The thing that hurts him most is when he says that Rob looks at me like an older brother.
Yeah.
And he's like, you will not name him brother. That's the guy. That's the son of the guy who killed your true brother.
Yeah.
If the Stark boy sends you to me like a trained raven, clutching his message.
The offer he makes is one I proposed.
He heeds your counsel.
I've lived with him, hunted with him, fought at his side. He thinks of me as a brother.
No, not here, not in my hearing. You will not name him brother. This son of the man who put your true brothers to the sword. Or have you forgotten your own blood?
Yeah. And you kind of sympathize with Balon there, right? Like, I mean, these were people who, you know, if we're going to paint the Greyjoys in the best light, like, the Greyjoys and the Iron Isles just wanted to do their own thing. They weren't even at that point looking to conquer things, right? They were just looking to be an independent nation.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, for daring to want to be independent, the Starks and the Baratheons came in, invaded their land, killed his sons, and took his other son as a kidnapped hostage.
Yeah.
That's pretty rough. I mean, like, I would probably hate that person too.
It's pretty rough. I mean, you look at it from Robert's perspective and you think, well, these guys don't, they don't want to contribute. They just want to take. Either we wipe them out or we subdue them. I think that those are the only options for the king of Westeros, because that guy, that island is only, its only resource is Westeros. So it's either going to be a part of that culture or it's going to be the enemy of that culture. There's no other way around it. But absolutely, you're right. If from the Greyjoy perspective, you're an occupied territory. You've been castrated. You've been demoralized.
Well, someone will get castrated. I don't know if it's Balon, but
let me just throw this at you both. Do you think that Martin knows at this point that what he's going to do to poor Theon?
Oh,
because
I don't know. Has he gardened? Did he find some kind of stake for his garden to chop it off? I don't know.
Was he gardening and he found an old pair of rusty pruning shears in the garden? Because it really does set him up as this is a guy who kind of lives by his cock. Like, he thinks with his cock and he's like all cock all the time, you know? And it, in the same way that sort of Jaime Lannister is his right hand,
mm-hmm.
Theon is his manhood, right? So
mm-hmm.
right. I do get a sense that, like, if Martin knows, boy, he's setting this up perfectly, because you almost want something horrible to happen to Theon after this.
Right.
Yeah.
But he kind of, I wouldn't doubt that he's got the Winterfell stuff figured out, right? Like mm-hmm. that he's going to go there and be responsible for, you know, some horrible stuff that, you know, to visit some horrors on the Stark family, the kids, right? I don't know if we go so far as the whole Reek situation. I don't know if he's got, you know, that plotted out. But isn't it, and again, this is where I, you know, between the books and the show, my brain gets a little muddy on that far out. But isn't Theon in some ways a kind of a Smeagol, like, character?
Reek, it rhymes with meek.
Yeah, you know, for the sake of, right, because he saves Sansa, right, in the end.
Well, in the books, it's not Sansa, it's Sansa's best friend.
Oh, okay. Jane Poole, something I don't recall.
Right?
Okay.
But it's almost the same storyline. It just, you know, they basically conflated those characters.
Okay.
But he does arc a little bit toward redemption toward the end of the last book. The last published book. I wonder if he has that in mind. We've already met a couple people in this book so far who have lost hands. They've been dismembered.
Mm-hmm.
And in a previous chapter, we had Tyrion kind of making fun of Varys for being dismembered. I wonder if Martin has thought that far. I wonder if he's thinking, I know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Well, this is too where, like, this, on the one hand, there are some really wonderful writing and descriptive writing. Uh-huh. And then on the other hand, there's a sex scene that I just don't need the details of it.
It's right. It's like, really gross.
Okay, say it is. It's gross old man stuff. And if he's like making fun of cripples and dismembered people and, you know, this kind of thing, it's like, this is where Martin sort of skirts this line of like, okay, gross old man, like,
right,
you know, keep us in the story here. We don't need these strange tangents of your mind.
You have this thing where people say, like, oh, well, it's not the author saying that, it's the character. And sure, that goes for a while. But then, like, if you go so long without hearing pushback to that, then it gets a little hard to defend it. But I guess, you know, maybe Martin had in mind here that he's going to take Theon down a peg. I don't know if he had a literal interpretation of that in mind, but, you know, I think that he knew that he was going to have him have a fall from grace at this point.
I feel like I just noted that there's this kind of throwaway statement about the history behind the Bloody Keep. And I'll talk about that in just a minute. But I do sometimes feel like if you look at Martin's chapters and you find the worst, darkest thing that happened in that chapter, chances are that's the part that he got from actual history.
Wow.
Right. Interesting.
So, like, for instance, they're talking about the story of the Bloody Keep, and it's like 1,000 years ago, you know, the sons of the River King were killed in their beds in this keep. And I noted, like, I had on a Scottish historian a while back, and he was telling me that the Red Wedding was modeled in part after the Glencoe Massacre. And basically that's, you know, the Campbells were like under the roof of their hosts, and as they were sleeping, the Campbells woke up and killed like 38 MacDonalds. And then when the rest of them fled, they chased him after and they killed him in the snow. And it's like, that's just kind of like a throwaway line in the middle of this chapter. And that sounds kind of, you know, murderous and dark. And yet that's the part from that's the one part from this chapter that is that has has an analog in history. I wonder if you could say the same thing for Theon and this woman he's done dirty to. I wonder if this is how high lords treated commoners back in the day. And it really does bring you to this sense of the disparity between someone of Theon's social status.
Sure.
And everyone else in this world, everyone else in this world is garbage to be discarded once you're done with them.
Right.
The small folk. Yeah.
I don't think that every lord feels that way. I don't think that all the high born in Westeros feel that way. I think that Theon, maybe because I think that we are seeing a person who feels entitled to a place at the table and who has such a fragile ego that all it takes is his dad going, well, you're dressed too pretty. And he just folds and immediately is ready to give up on like all the bonds he's ever made.
Are you guys Succession fans?
No, we're not. Neither of us.
Neither one of you are Succession. I was just thinking.
I've never seen an episode.
So. Theon, it would be the kind of guy that would absolutely be on that show. Mm-hmm. They're on that show. There's this phrase that they use. You know, this is basically a billionaire family. There's this phrase that they use, like, not a real person. And basically, they use not a real person for anyone who's not has political or monetary value,
power. Has any kind of power.
Yeah, like the serving class, like you and me, we're not real people. And so our lives are garbage. And I do get the sense that Theon is that kind of guy. It's like, there are people in this world that can do things for me. And there are other people who can't really do much for me. And when I'm done with them, I treat them like garbage.
So does this then point to another failure of Ned Stark, that he didn't properly educate his ward? Like give his ward a good moral center from which to live his life from?
I don't know about that, because if I could push back on that, like,
please.
Jon Snow was also treated like shit growing up.
Yeah.
And raised by the same family and did not turn out this way. So I think that this was maybe something that he learned from, you know, but what was he, like 10 or 11 years old when he got made a ward? So
yeah.
I guess he could have picked it up in his early childhood. It's not like you don't learn things.
Yeah, you got to get a sense in this chapter that he says at one point, he says, every now and again, Ned would try to play the father with him.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, he knew he was a hostage and everyone else knew he was a hostage. And he always felt like that. And so I think it could, both things could be true. I think Ned probably treated him like a hostage most of the time, or a war, you know, at the very best a ward, but never a son. And on top of that, I think you could kind of point to like Theon's own responsibility of this. I mean, sometimes you do your best as a parent and
doesn't
it doesn't
work out.
Right?
Right. Yeah. But here's, I'm still going to argue the point a little bit, which is, wouldn't you be smart in some ways strategically to curry this person who is going to eventually go back in their adulthood to somewhere else? And wouldn't that be sort of a smart thing to create some bonds that are more positive than negative? I mean, certainly Rob treats Theon, you know, Theon has a good mm-hmm. estimation of Rob and is willing to be his envoy mm-hmm. in a bit here. Mm-hmm. But certainly Theon doesn't have a moral center of like, I'm a noble, I need to treat people, the small folk, a certain way. And he doesn't. He uses and abuses his authority and power.
I don't know if Ned ever thinks that Theon's going home.
Okay, interesting.
I think a lot of the times these hostage arrangements were such that we're going to keep this person as long as we need to.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And to guarantee your good behavior. And unless it's like specified in the contract, we're going to keep this person for this many years and return him at this time. And at which time you're then going to give us a different hostage or something like that. Okay. I don't know the arrangements here. I don't know, but I honestly, I'm not sure if Ned has given any thought to this guy being the actual heir to the Iron Islands.
Right. He's just holding he's using Theon as a pawn, mm-hmm. holding the Iron Islands in check.
Here's the other thing about Ned is that he is, you know, he talks a good game, but
right.
By the sort of the common wisdom of everyone at Winterfell, he actually sired a bastard. And so why wouldn't Theon think that that would be his right as well?
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think around more of Ned here to see if we can pick apart his character flaws.
Well, I mean, if you have Theon being this person who's ready to discard people he sees as lesser, maybe that's because he feels like he was seen as lesser by Ned Stark, you know? I mean, and sure. And he was, like, he certainly was.
Like hurt Ned, people hurt people.
Ned and the rest of the Northerners are very like, the North remembers, you know, they have Confederate flags up, like you said. But no, they're very like into this like old North blood. Yeah, we're the first men, this and that. And like, you have this guy over here and you're like, oh yeah. And there's this guy who he doesn't even want to be here. He's just a token. We just keep him here so that Balon doesn't mess with us.
Here's one other thing that I noticed in this chapter that I liked is that from Theon's perspective, Jon Snow was always of higher stature than he was.
Mm.
Now, even though he was a little bit older
and not a bastard.
Yeah, from Theon's perspective, Jon Snow was more welcome at Winterfell than he was. Now, that could just be a sort of a distorted view of his place. But if you look at Jon Snow's POVs, he doesn't give a second thought to Theon. If Theon's not in the actual same space as Jon, he doesn't even give a second. He doesn't pine about Theon. He doesn't think about, like, he has no sort of fond memories of Theon. He doesn't even register as a person to Jon Snow. So I think we do give Jon Snow like a lot of leeway because, you know, how hard it would have been to grow up as a bastard at Winterfell. I think that Theon should probably get a little of that sympathy as well. You know, maybe Jon was even of higher social standing.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, Catelyn certainly treated Jon terribly growing up, but it doesn't seem like Catelyn liked Theon that much either. If you see like how hesitant she is, how much she wants to discourage Rob from sending him.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem like that she had a good relationship with either of these people. You know, if Catelyn Stark were like 10% nicer to the people who weren't her newborn kids, like the plot of this book would just be over.
Well, I was just gonna praise Catelyn. I was thinking, well, she was proven right. She told Rob, do not let him go back to the Iron Islands. He absolutely should have heeded her advice. He should not have let Theon go back.
Well, maybe instead of pointing fingers at Ned and his failings, we should be pointing our fingers at Catelyn.
Yeah.
Catelyn.
Even so, I mean, this is a good question. Is there anything that the Starks could have done to change the way that Balon would have received him. Because my view is that Theon could have done everything right and come with it the best of intentions and been a perfect angel on the boat over and not expected a warm welcome and not worn the golden chain. If he had done everything right, do you think Balon would have treated him any differently? I don't think he would have.
I think if he had shown up in a longboat that he had stolen himself and cut the throats of, you know, the captain.
The blood is smeared on his face and he's just...
Yeah. Yeah. Then I think Balon would have been like, okay, now we're talking. Now that's my son. But and anything else, a perfumed, dressed up courtier looking like guy, yeah.
I wonder if he shown up in the way that you've just mentioned. I think that might have been respected more. I think that these Ironborn are suspicious by nature. I think that they might think this guy has become a wolf. He's been with the wolves too long. When I look at him, I can't help but remember my defeat to the hands of Ned Stark.
Oh, totally.
You know,
completely. Which is why at the end he says, "You're not going to Casterly Rock. You know, you've got another destination. I'm sending you somewhere else."
Right.
Which is like, right, I'm going to spit right back in the eye of the Starks by sending, you know, my son, back to stab him in the heart.
That's right. That's right.
And that's a good leader for that expedition. Like, he's going to know the ins and outs of that town, that city. One thing I'll say is maybe if Rob went with Theon and really leveled with Balon, there's a slight chance he has a better time and because he's like treating Balon as an equal.
Mm.
But even then, I think that Balon just has too much hatred for the Starks. And I it's still not a guaranteed
completely
win.
Well, let me
give
ask
me
you
a
this
crown. Give me a crown. I'm going to take my crown. I mean, like, that just flies in the face of Iron culture or Iron Islands culture, right?
Okay. So at the end of this chapter, basically, Balon says, "We're going to war. We're not going to be anyone's ally. I'm going to take what's mine. And screw the Starks," basically, right?
Yeah.
If you are Theon, and this is your father, and you're heir to the Iron Islands, or at least you think you are, and yet you've been raised with the Starks, and your best friend is you basically just proclaimed your best friend King of the North. What do you do? What you're kind of at a moral fork. Which road do you take,
John?
Oh, you're going to throw that to me?
Yeah, oh, first. I'll answer, but I just thought I'd give you an opportunity to lead.
Well, I don't know. It's a tough choice. I mean, I wouldn't do what he did, for sure. I wouldn't go burning kids and stuff like that. I guess the most moral thing he could do is be like, "Hey, Rob, my uncle's coming. I'll do my best to hold them off." But at the same time, he's betraying his whole family there.
You either betray your family or you don't. Martin is kind of brilliant at this. We talked about his writing.
Yeah, he is.
He's put Theon in an impossible position. Impossible. Either he betrays his best friend and the family that raised him, or he betrays his biological family. There's no middle ground here, right?
What does he do? I mean, he is in line, right, you know, between him and his sister to being, you know, the leader of the Iron Islands, regardless of his leadership qualities, just by, you know, dint of bloodline. So where does he go if he doesn't go there? The Starks aren't necessarily going to have him back. The kingdom.
Oh no,
about,
the Starks,
you know,
could
go to war.
The Starks would take him back if he wanted to.
Mm-hmm. If Rob would take him,
he
back.
Would go. He could go back to Rob and said, "I'm loyal to you. I'm going to be your man. I've forsaken Pike entirely. They won't have me back anyway." I think Rob would take him back, right?
But then when we look at somebody like Jaime, you know, the Kingslayer, or, you know, if you're a bastard, like, you never live that stuff down.
Yeah.
People are always going to give you the side eye.
I think being known as a traitor to your own family, I think you wear that. I think that no matter what happens for the rest of your life, you kind of wear that. Like, how do we know that you can be loyal to us if you weren't even loyal to your own father? I think he's going to have consequences no matter what. But I absolutely think that he's going to have Rob's. He's going to have a seat at Rob's table always,
as long as Rob is alive and in power,
which isn't very long. Right?
No,
that's a good point. He either does what he does or he dies at the Red Wedding. Those are the options.
But wasn't the Red Wedding in part because of this? Like, because Rob wouldn't have needed to cross there if he could have had Balon's fleet. Like, he would not have needed there. Am I right here? Like,
no, that betrothal has already been arranged.
Okay.
But he doesn't have to go back to the Freys. Yeah.
Right, but he goes back because he needs something else from them, right? And he wouldn't have needed that something else if Theon and the Greyjoys hadn't betrayed him.
I think you're right. I don't know. Maybe if Theon takes Casterly Rock, maybe they don't have to go back to the Freys at all, and then the Red Wedding doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I do think, though, that there's... Well, I want to give you guys both a chance to answer. So, John, what was your answer?
All right, here's how I'm going to think about it. Is if you have two friends, and they don't like each other, and one of them says, you can only be friends with me or them, then you pick the one who didn't give you the ultimatum, right?
Yeah, but one of these is your father.
Who you haven't seen in 10 years, who just backhanded you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. He's not a warm father. I don't think they have a good relationship. Like, how well does Theon know him?
All the descriptions of Theon returning to Pike, you know, it's like moldy and it's wet and it's cold and it's damp and it's a brutal place.
Yeah.
Where at least, you know, Winterfell, okay, it's in the north, but it's not this.
He says there's a fire in the
right,
hearth.
Exactly. Here, his room wasn't even like...
They put him in a room that no one's been in 20 years. I mean...
Exactly.
It's pretty bad. There's no warm welcome at all. But at the end of the day, don't you have to... In this world, where lineage is everything, where bloodlines are everything, don't you have to kind of say, sorry, Rob, I gotta do what my dad says?
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard for me to put myself in that headspace because we don't live in that world, right? Yeah. Where lineage is everything.
So John Punts, what about you, David?
I think as Theon, right, I would have to double down.
Yeah.
And I would have to, you know, take up the drowned god and the what did Aaron say about the comet, you know, like this is the firebrand of our god, you know, which is an interesting point because everybody's got their own interpretation of this bloody comet, right?
Yeah, we got two more interpretations of this show.
So I think, you know, if you're Theon and you've got these ambitions and you want to be the heir to Pike, you've got to be more of a reaver than any reaver ever reaved, right? You've got to be, and Theon does try, I would say, but he's just so bad at it, you know, and he gets morally conflicted, I think, if I remember correctly.
I think so. Yeah.
When he goes to try to dispose of the kid, right? Because he ends up burning a couple of fake bodies or whatever to make people think that he killed Rickon and Bran.
So you would double down and kind of say, I'm the new Lord Reaper. I'm going to start acting like
if I'm Theon, that's what I got to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Because my ambition is outside.
What would happen if
my ambition is outsized? You know, my appetite is bigger than my, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make. Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time. Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Okay, let me just run in a hypothetical at you. Theon has got a dagger and a sword on his hip, walks in the room, they're alone. He realizes his dad is this frail, old, bitter man. What would be the consequences if he just killed him? Patricide. Mm. What would be the consequence?
I don't know that his uncle or his sister would accept it. I accept him as the new ruler.
Isn't that what Euron does, though? I mean, Euron walks in, throws him off a bridge, says, "I killed him. I'm the Lord."
But now, I think Euron has got...
it works for Euron,
can back
right?
it up, right? Like, he's actually got the...
Yeah.
Not that I wouldn't put it past Theon to employ some sort of stratagem like that, but he just doesn't have...
He doesn't have the network.
The network nor that salt toughness.
Yeah.
You know, of being on the high seas and, you know, and reaving.
Yeah,
and
he would probably be like, "You're the wolf's assassin." I mean, right. He's in an impossible position. And yeah. And Martin is just brilliant at creating these impossible decisions for people like this.
Yeah. Certainly that is one of his best parts, and another one of the brilliant things, which I think we've alluded to a lot of times during this episode, is just the way that he makes you hate a character so much and want them to get justice, and then they do, and then you're like, oh, not like that, and then you want them to, you sort of root for them by the end of it. I mean, that's really like if I'm going to pick the highlight of Martin's writing, that's
yeah,
it
to
for
take
me.
Someone who pushed a kid out the window and then kind of make him into the hero.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
it's
a good
like
point.
How right. What kind of voodoo
very
are you
hard.
Playing with here, Martin? Anything else about this chapter that you noted that you'd like to call out?
Yeah, I had this one quote that I enjoyed when I was reading this chapter, and just, you know, okay, so, you know, gross old man stuff aside, and master manipulator, right, of plot lines too, he can write. Like, the man can string some sentences together, and this
he really can.
This jumped out at me. This is a description that, you know, as Theon is on the boat and they're approaching Pike, he says, the point of land on which the Greyjoys had raised their fortress had once thrust like a sword into the bowels of the ocean, but the waves had hammered at it day and night until the land broke and shattered. Thousands of years passed. All that remained were three bare and barren islands and a dozen towering stacks of rocks that rose from the water like pillars of some sea god's temple, while the angry waves foamed and crashed among them. Like, I have such a vivid picture in my mind of these islands. It's just like brilliant. Really, really enjoyed that.
Really great.
Thrust like a sword, you know, like, oh, like really, like there's so much action and emotion and history built into this very economical. It's a very economical two sentences.
Do you guys ever follow Martin's Not a Blog?
I do not.
I am on Reddit, and then I see somebody post that he says, yeah, I'm still writing it, and then that's all I see.
About a month ago, he posted this mention of Casterly Rock. At one point, Theon and Baelon are debating whether or not he could actually take Casterly Rock he's like, no one's ever taken the rock. And Theon basically retorts, he says, until now. And he's, you know, he's got a gleam in his eye. Martin posted this thing about what Casterly Rock is actually like. It's like a mountain. It's like the Prudential logo.
Uh-huh.
It's basically this giant solid rock of a mountain. And they've built the castle in the interior of the mountain.
Wow.
There's like, you know, 20 feet of solid rock around every wall of the keep, basically. And it goes up a lot higher than the keep. And there's a bit that is on the very top. But that's just for, you know, military purposes. That you really get the sense that this place is impenetrable. And so I think Baelon has the right of it when he says, your plan is foolish. You think that you're just going to waltz in and take Casterly Rock? No one's ever done that.
Mm.
And I think the implication is, that place will never be sieged. I think that Martin posted this image to like an artist's rendering of Casterly Rock, and it looks totally different than anything I'd ever imagined.
I'm looking at one right now, and it's from the Wiki of Ice and Fire, and it almost looks lion-like with a couple of paw protrusions sticking out. So yeah.
Oh, that would make sense.
Yeah.
So the actual the natural mountain.
Yes. Yeah. Like there's a couple of pieces of rock that stick out.
That'd be a nice little detail for sure. I think we talked about the departures from the book, the show departures from the book already, in terms of the Asha Yara character, but were there any other notable differences that you saw here?
Not notable. I think in the book he goes to his rooms and changes, and I think in the show he goes straight into the Solar, and then Yara joins
that's
him.
Right.
So, but to me, the variances in the show all work really well. They move the plot along for the pacing. They introduce the right characters. I like that the uncle is added later because that gives him more dramatic import. And then they set up Yara and Theon's rivalry right from the start, and so that increases the stakes for Theon. So I thought all the differences here worked well for the show.
Mm-hmm.
The name change was a very good idea too, because otherwise Osha and Asha, that was going to be a mess.
That's a good point. I will note that, you know, with Theon kind of asking around about all the people that he remembered and finding out they're all dead. You know, where's this person, where's that person? Oh, they're dead. That person was swallowed by the sea. That person has been dead for a long time. It really does give you the sense that, like, you know, it's like he doesn't know anyone here. You know, his uncle's changed dramatically. You know, his father seems smaller and more withered than he was before. This is like the worst homecoming in the history of homecomings.
Yeah, it sets up the whole sort of tragedy, I guess, nicely, because there's no warmth here, and it's going to get worse from here.
It shatters Theon in such a way that he grabs onto the first rock he finds, right? The first raft he can find.
Good point.
Is what he grabs onto, and that's what Balon offers him. He says, "Hey, I'll take you up. I'll raise you up, and you can go fight for me, and you can go take Winterfell, and we'll have a great time together."
Yeah. It really does deconstruct him, right? I mean, he starts this chapter. What is it? Everyone's got a different interpretation of the comet. What does Theon say? He says, "That's my comet."
Yeah.
this is the most
arrogant. I'm a made man.
This is the most arrogant son of a bitch ever. Everyone else is like attributing the comet to like the gods or a sign, or maybe it means war. Theon is just like, "Yep, it's mine." And by the end of the chapter, he's totally deconstructed.
That's a good point. I think that that's a really good way to frame what's happened to him. Again, he's a made man, and then he goes, oh, shit.
Yep.
And that's basically the chapter.
Notable departures. Well, we meet the captain and the captain's daughter. We also see the departure of the letter, you know, the letter that Theon is holding. He just thinks that this is my ticket to the throne. And he just sees it like cast aside like refuse into the burn up in the hearth.
Burned along with the necklace.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The whorish necklace. It's all gone in a snap for poor Theon. Guys, thank you so much for jumping on the pod. And we should absolutely connect again in some capacity.
Yeah, our conversation around Andor was really fun. I thought that was a great way for us to end the season. And yeah, I look forward to the next time we get to, you know, you should come on the Silmarillion stories.
I'd love to do that. What do you guys got going in terms, if people want to search for you, what's the podcast called? And what shows are you covering these days?
So you can find us. We set up a new website, thelorehounds.com, and that's got all of our stuff there. And you can just find us on the your podcast app of choice by searching The Lorehounds. Right now we are covering The Last of Us. And that is coming to a conclusion about the time that this comes out. So hopefully, fingers crossed, we will have had an excellent season so far.
So for people who need a show to binge watch if they're not already watching, HBO Max, The Last of Us, and then, of course, your companion pod, The Lorehounds.
Yes.
Very cool.
And we've got a ton of other stuff in 2023 television-wise going. We're waiting for Wheel of Time, and we've got some Star Wars stuff. So, yeah, we've got a lot going on, actually.
So, search The Lorehounds. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review.
Please.
I'm sure that they would appreciate all of those things. It's hard to tell. It's hard to describe to people how grateful we podcasters are when they subscribe, rate, and review.
Mm-hmm.
It really does.
It means a lot.
If you actually tangibly want to help, there's no better way to do that than rate, and review. Folks, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
This is awesome.
And now, Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
Speaking of Ted Danson, does his career have nearly the impact it does if he is Theodore Danson?
I think his career goes a much different direction. I think he's a film actor.
Well, I mean, don't sleep on Three Men and a Baby, Three Men and a Little Lady.
If he's Theodore, I think he gets cast as Superman and we never know Christopher Reeve.
Oh, wow. That's a big move.
Yeah.
Christopher Reeve is in Cheers.
Exactly.
That's quite the swap.
Yeah. I would go with that. That's not a bad swap. I would.
It's a reasonable swap. I definitely think that the Christopher Reeve as Sam Malone probably is a better swap than Theodore Danson as the man.
I see Christopher. I buy him better as a major league relief pitcher than I do.
Yeah, I could see that. See, I feel like Christopher Reeve could have played every character in Cheers, including Carla.
I'd be willing to watch that.
Somebody please deep fake an episode where Christopher Reeves is everyone. Except Lilith, for some reason.